Welcome to the Stand Up for Migrants podcast from the UN Human Rights Office, which focuses on bringing you exciting projects that can help inspire all of us to help change the narrative on migration towards one of hope, inclusion, and a larger us. Today, we are going to be examining the power of storytelling and why it's important, who is telling the story, and who is asking the questions. I'm going to be joined by guests Ali Jihad and Robin Hammond from the 1000 Dreams Project. The 1000 Dreams Project aims to contribute to narrative change by sharing the stories of 1000 refugees. The entire project is reported by refugees themselves. Robin Hammond is a photographer and created the 1000 Dreams Project. And Ali Jihad is also a photographer, originally from Iraq, now living in Sweden. And I'm your host, Christina McGilvery, with the UN Human Rights Office. Thank you both for joining us today in this discussion, Robin Hammond and Ali Jihad. I'd love to hear a bit about how did the two of you first meet?
It was a cold winter's morning in the middle of... No, this is not a joke. It was. Is it, you better tell the story, Ali. You're probably better at it.
It was about 4 or 5 years ago. A very cold and dry winter. And someone contacted me and told me, like, hey, you should look into this. This photographer is coming into town. He's working on this big project based on immigration to Europe and stuff like that. And we I got to work alongside Robin, and really fun. And then we kept in touch since then.
And Robin, can you tell me about how you first got the idea for the 1000 Dreams Project?
It was a collaborative sort of process with the Open Societies Foundations, who've been supporting Witness Change for a couple of years. They've been helping us with our mental health work, and we wanted to do some work around people on the move and mental health, and the narratives that were constructed amongst I guess what we call host populations in European countries, how they perceived refugees and how those perceptions affected the lives and especially the mental health of refugees in Europe. But with this, I really wanted to take a much more, I guess, passive role in terms of the storytelling and as much as possible, put the stories and the telling of those stories in the hands of refugees themselves.
It sounds like you've always had a participatory element in the type of work that you're doing. But with 1000 Dreams, you really wanted to take a back seat, it sounds like.
I think participatory work has real value, but I don't think it's the only valid kind of storytelling. And I think that journalism plays a really, really important role in free societies. And I think the world would be much worse off if we didn't have professional storytellers. But it's not a great situation when you have a group of people who pretty much never are authors of their own stories. And I think it's the case with refugees. And I think that many refugees arrive in countries where they don't speak the language fluently, where they're feeling very vulnerable, where they don't necessarily know or feel empowered to stand up for their rights. And therefore, those who end up telling their stories are others. And sometimes it's media groups who might have be well intentioned, some not, or you have different political organizations who feel that they can use a version of refugee stories in order to somehow gain or stay in power. So anyway, and from a journalist's point of view, I have told stories of refugees in the past, and I like to think that those stories have been authentic and well-meaning, but it definitely makes a difference who tells the stories. And I think that the point of this work was, what if refugees had the opportunity, the skills, and the platforms to be able to tell and share their own stories themselves? And that was really, where 1000 Dreams was starting from.
Ali, can you tell me a bit about your background?
I'm a photographer, freelance photographer from Sweden, originally a political refugee from Iraq. I was born and lived there as a kid. Spent some years in a refugee camp after the Gulf War in Saudi Arabia. and ended up in Sweden due to the UN refugee program in the 90s. Come from a photography family. I'm a third generation photographer. And
You're a third generation photographer?
Yeah, my grandfather was the first professional photographer in South Iraq. He had a studio back from the 40s, and we ran a photography studio for 50 years in Iraq.
What? And, that's cool.
You go back there and you ask any older person if they remember Jihad, the photographer, or if they know of him. He took pictures of every single family, every single person who's lived in that village during the last 70 years or so.
Wow.
Right now, I'm in the process of acquiring all his work, because all my grandfather's work still exists in Iraq. It's in a box in the home of an old man.
Hold on one second. It's in the box. Old man.
Yeah, because when we fled Iraq, we couldn't bring everything with us. It was bare necessities. It was a little bit of clothes and a few, like I think one album of photos that my mom stashed with our bag, and all the stuff that we had in our studio that my grandfather ran from the 40s, and my father and uncles worked in. All that work was just put in a box, and it ended up in an old man's house. And I went back to Iraq and tried to acquire it, but he's a little bit hesitant of letting it go. But I'm in the process of getting it, because this man is getting really old, and I'm not losing all that work. So I'm lucky, even though living in a refugee camp for many years and going through, you know, process of losing everything, to have a father who's a photographer and uncles. So even though we had very, very little with us, we have photographs to document the whole story, you know, from my family's history back in the early 1900s until now. So, my goal eventually is to kind of archive everything.
That is incredible.
you might think it's weird for someone to kind of hold photographs hostage, but Iraqis and a lot of other people come from cultures like ours, with the history that we got with wars and losing everything, they're extremely sentimental. So even with photographs that come from someone else of other people, they value and treasure the history of the land and of the culture that they grew up in. So I just figured I'd just learn by shooting. And I lived in China, I lived in Australia, and I was just taking pictures of different cultures, different people everywhere I go. And eventually I realized that the only place I wanted to focus on was kind of myself and my history. And since I can't go back in time and, you know, meet my family when we were living in a refugee camp, I changed my focus into working more with refugees living in refugee camps, similar to the ones that I lived in.
If there's anyone listening that wants to sponsor a wonderful book project, there's an opportunity here. Ali, you just shared traveling to refugee camps and taking portraits and doing interviews. What is significant about who is behind the camera and who is asking questions?
Personally, for me, I never really thought so much about the perspective, you know, like who gets to answer questions and who, you know, ends up using the stories or talks to the refugees themselves. And it hit me the first time in 2018 when I was when we were in Lebanon, and we went to a settlement, and the sheikh of the settlement, the leader of the family, someone who represents them, he didn't want the larger group of people to go in there. And as everyone went to work on something else, I walked back and I started talking to them, you know, about me, and I introduced myself, and they took me in, and they brought me around the camp. They had me meet all the families. They, you know, had me sit down with, you know, they gave me tea, and I got the opportunity to shoot whatever I want in that camp, because from talking to me in our discussions for even just for 20 minutes, they realized that I was looking at life and the world kind of with the same eyes as they do. We might be speaking English or Arabic, the language that you use it's shaped around who you're talking to always. So when you're talking to someone that does understand what you've gone through, the language changes, and you don't, you know, it just the heavy points and the focuses of that conversation they lay completely different than, and you know, in comparison to when you're talking to a, you know, a white journalist or someone, you know, European or American or anything like that. So it just becomes a completely different conversation.
Can I also just ask, because I know that Ali, you've spoken before also about some of the challenges of being really familiar as well. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, definitely. Something that, you know, I realized started happening was that, you know, I've talked about my story so many times to people, you know, trying to make them understand about the fundamentals. And as I was listening to other refugees talking about things, it almost got to the point to where I missed out on like important points and important details, because for me, they didn't really stick out as much, you know, but to someone who's never talked to a refugee, that might be something super important, you know. And it made me really have to focus in a completely different way than I thought I had to do when I was just starting out doing the interviews. And it gave me a different perspective. It's almost like a third perspective, because I do have the understanding, but then suddenly I have to realize that I'm not just speaking to other refugees. I'm speaking to the whole Western world and people who have never read anything about refugees. So I have to kind of be this middle ground.
Ali, when you said that that sometimes you bring so much to that interview that there's things that you find you wouldn't even pay attention to because they're so normalized, you take it maybe for granted, that experience or that part of that story. You know, I'm wondering as well, what is it that, how do these stories translate to an audience that has never had these experiences? At UN Human Rights, you know, we're trying to always focus on individual stories and also the things that people share no matter where you are from and what experiences you have or have not had. Things like love and family, whatever you're passionate about. These are some of the things that helps people, you know, understand one another as human beings, no matter where they've come from. What have you observed in doing these stories? What translates?
I mean, definitely the dreams and ambitions and, you know, hopes that the individuals that I've talked to has carried for most of their life. We all have dreams. We all have ambitions. We all have, you know, things we want to be when we grow up, when we're kids. And so that's the whole point. That's the whole, you know, the path we're walking.
I'm learning so much from the storytellers and the stories that they are able to tell, you know, how normal these people are. They're just absolutely, just like you and I, normal people who've been thrust into really extraordinary situations. And I think that, you know, they're really this form of really personal storytelling, which I think that these storytellers have managed to bring out in such an authentic way, just really, I think, really bridges this gap and I think sort of, you know, knocks down some of the barriers, these artificial barriers that we make between distance and or religion or because of nationality, whatever it might be, that the sort of the fact that we can see that these are just normal people going through extraordinary situations, I think that there's going to be a story, at least one, that everyone can relate to. And I remember relating very specifically to, you know, when I started this work, I just had a baby, and relating very specifically to fathers who'd been separated from their children, you know, it's like, and their dream was to be reunited with their child. And it's like, I mean, of course, right? I mean, it's like, if I've been separated from my child, absolutely. Forget everything else. That's all I would want too. And I could totally see myself in that situation, just desperately wanting to be reunited with my family and nothing else.
Robin, what are the harmful narratives that you wanted to combat with this project?
Let's use Europe as the example. I think it's really clear that so many of the narratives we hear about refugees are how they are a burden on social services, on economies, how they are a threat to cultures and to, you know, ways of life. It's very much, you know, this continuous sort of overwhelming toxic narrative where we talk about, you know, we've been overwhelmed and being like a tsunami or a surge or boatfuls of refugees are are coming. You know, I'm sitting here in the UK, and it's like the number of refugees that come to the UK compared to a country like Turkey or Jordan, you know, is minuscule. Yet you would think that, you know, that the country was going to be, you know, completely awash with these strange and dangerous people. And those stories have real life impacts. The government here is spending millions and millions of pounds just to try and stop the few desperate people trying to reach these shores. And those policies are really driven by those narratives, which I think are often politically motivated.
And then why individual portraits and one-on-one interviews? What does that do?
Well, I think it's about creating connection. And I think that the you know, a lot of these portraits are people facing straight at the camera, looking straight at the viewer. And I think that, you know, there's just a human thing about looking into someone else's eyes and perhaps, you know, those eyes reflecting yourself back in them. And the interviews, you know, are talking to an audience often who haven't spoken to a refugee before. So, we have this connection, and then I think interaction. I think, you know, one of the most powerful ways to break down any sort of prejudice or stigma is for you to meet somebody from that group that's prejudiced or stigmatized. And we can't create a project where every European gets to meet a refugee, but we can, I'd like to think, come partway. And I think that these stories, you know, get people partway to that meeting and engagement and personal interaction with this group of people.
Ali, I know you came to the project as a photographer. Were you also a journalist?
No, that's something that I had to kind of fall into and learn a lot about. I'm still learning so much. I've strictly been someone who talks so much that people end up just being quiet and standing in front of the camera. I don't know how to really be quiet. So understanding how to ask the right questions.
What did you learn the most about how to ask questions? What's something that really resonated with you in taking that role versus being the talker?
Just really kind of using my refugee background as an entrance tool, as a key to get in contact with the person, but then at the same time, closing a door on all that so that I can talk to them as someone who, you know, doesn't know, doesn't understand. And it's pretty tricky.
And what do you mean by closing a door on that?
I don't want them to to talk to me, or I mean, they do end up talking to me like I'm a fellow refugee. But I don't want to ask my questions as someone who is a refugee, you know. Mm-hmm. I want to relate to them and connect with them as a refugee, but I want to ask the questions as someone who's trying to understand every aspect of it. Mm-hmm. It's a bit complex, and it took me a while to get into it, because in the beginning I was just sitting there and they would say stuff about a specific war and then this happened or someone died. I'd be like, oh, yeah, I get that. And then I've caught myself like, wait, no, like the person who's reading this isn't going to get that. So, you know, so that was definitely one of the things that I had to, I'm still learning a lot about.
That's an interesting point, you know, that you bring that feeling to the interview. And part of your role in this project is to help translate these things, to straddle both worlds and be able to draw that story out in a way that resonates between two places.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty good way of explaining it. Like, you're straddling with one foot in each world and you're trying to, you know, you become a chameleon in every single aspect, personality-wise, language-wise. But it works.
That's something that this project really does, is help people see parts of themselves and values and experiences that no matter where they come from. So thank you both for putting it together. I'm wondering if there is one way that our listeners, anyone listening to this, can take some of what we've talked about today and put it into practice in their own daily life.
You know, I think that we all could try to, you know, open up spaces for refugees to be heard, and maybe it's, you know, literal physical spaces, but also maybe it's within our own communities. You know, and I think, you know, if you imagine that, you know, you have arrived in a country where maybe you don't speak the language fluently, where you've heard stories of hostility towards you, you know, maybe, you know, being just the person who says hello can make a massive difference and make someone feel not so afraid or threatened, or and make them feel welcome if they're in a new place. And I think, you know, and just being willing to listen.
Thank you both. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Do you have an inspiring project or story to share that helps change the narrative on migration? We would love to hear from you on Facebook or Twitter. To learn more about some of the strategies we discussed in today's podcast, you can consult our online toolbox on narrative change on migration. The Stand Up for Migrants podcast is produced by the UN Human Rights Office.